Well, brethren, we're just about to depart, not from this life. We're just about to depart to attend one of the most important commanded assemblies of the year, the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll enjoy traveling to where God has placed His name. We'll enjoy wonderful spiritual meals in the sermons, the split sermons, the sermonettes we'll hear. We'll likely enjoy a few special meals during the feast. Foods that we might not be able to afford during the other parts of the year. Drinks that we might not normally partake of. We'll no doubt participate in special activities. Tours, dances, sightseeing. And we'll do all that with brethren of like mind from around the country or even brethren from around the world. Or we may be going to a site outside of the United States and enjoy the company of brethren maybe whose language we cannot speak. Regardless, we'll come home spiritually rejuvenated. We'll be armed with spiritual ammunition to face the future and the trials and the tests that the future always brings. So we might summarize by saying we'll come home with good spiritual meat to study and meditate over. We'll come home with fond memories of activities that we've shared. We'll come home with stronger relationships forged over fellowship and food with brothers and sisters in the faith. We'll come home with lots of dirty clothes that need to be cleaned. No, we shouldn't probably mention that one. That's not something we look forward to. But we'll come home with pictures of the sights and the sounds of the feast site in which we feasted. Still shots, video shots, mental images. We'll come home maybe with a few souvenirs of the area in which we feasted. But what we should not come home with is debt. Feast debt. We should not come home with debt piled high as a result of our keeping the feast. It would be a sad thing, quite frankly, probably depressing, to come home from a wonderful feast wondering how we're going to pay for all the things that we just enjoyed. Or wondering how we're going to buy groceries, or pay the rent, or make the mortgage payment, or put clothes on our backs, or fix the car because of this mountain of feast debt. Well, we know God has instructed us in a way of preparing for His feasts that eliminates debt. A plan of saving so that we prepare in advance to keep His feasts. In this manner, we can joyfully obey the great God of the universe and His commands without the pressure of worrying of mounting debt that we'll have to face when we arrive home. So today I'd like to, brethren, go over with you an instructional sermon on the subject of festival tithe. Festival tithe, also referred to as second tithe. I may have told you the story a number of years ago, visiting someone new. I was always instructed as a young minister not to shy away from the topic of tithing. When you're counseling new people, make sure they understand the biblical instruction about tithing. Not because the church wants their money, but because the church is interested in having God's people be obedient to God. So don't shy away from teaching tithing. So when we visit a new person, at some point along the way, we always talk about what the biblical command is regarding tithing. And then we talk about the biblical command regarding second tithe. Well, one new person thought I had said, "Are you familiar with seventh tithe?" Thinking first tithe, second tithe, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. Seven tithes? No, I'm not familiar with that. Then they were relieved to find out there were only two. Oh, a second tithe. That's much better. But why give a sermon such as this 1 month before the Feast of Tabernacles begins? What's the point? What good will it do us now? Well, if we've been observing the principle of festival tithe, this will serve as a good reminder of what God teaches us and a biblical reinforcement of what we practice. If we've not been observing this principle of festival tithe, it will help us to begin to restructure our lives and our finances. So at this time in the calendar next year, we'll be anticipating the observance of the feast and all that it entails, rather than stressing over combining these feast anticipations with the worry of how we're going to pay for all of this. Let's go into the scriptures to talk about the principles regarding festival tithe. Let's begin by simply stating everything belongs to God. Everything belongs to God. Turn with me to Psalm 19. Now, why do we begin with this principle? It's not even talking about tithe. Well, it helps us to understand, in our tendency to be in the materialistic Western world and to absorb that materialism, we think of things as ours. One of the interesting things that the Native American populations had a hard time grasping when white settlers came to America, they had the hardest time grasping this concept of land ownership. It didn't make sense to them. The land is the land. You live on the land. Now, I'm not saying that was a good concept or a bad concept. Certainly, the Bible talks about land ownership, and when it's done properly, it's a very positive thing. God told Adam to dress and keep the garden. So, land ownership can be a wonderful thing. It should allow us to enhance the property that we own. Make it better. Dress it and keep it. Not just maintain it, but dress it and make it nicer as we go along. That's our responsibility. They had a hard time understanding this concept of ownership of land. And frankly, brethren, it helps us a great deal to always have this understanding that everything is really God's anyway. Oh, we might have temporary possession of it or care of it, dressing and keeping it, but it really is God's. And when we look at things that way, we tend to be less selfish, less grasping, because it's not really ours anyway. It's owned by God. Turn to, Psalm. Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19 and verse 5. Notice what's said here. Exodus 19, verse 5. Now, therefore, God says, again, he's speaking to Israel. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice. Exodus 19, verse 5. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people. We have a responsibility to obey God's voice and keep His covenant. So we strive to put aside all the excuses that we might use not to obey God's voice, not to keep His covenant, including that covenant regarding the holy days. And then He says, you'll be a special treasure to me above all people. Then He makes a statement that we'll focus on for just a moment. The end of verse 5 says this, for all the earth is mine. God simply says, I own it all. I created it. I produced the raw materials. I gave everything to you that you need to survive. Not only does He own the earth, He owns us. Again, when we start with that concept, that it's all God's anyway, it helps us to get out of the worry, the materialistic worry of everyday living. How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? God owns everything. If God can create a supernova, is it any difficulty for Him to send a few dollars our way when we really need it? If we really do need it, turn now again to the book of Psalms. Psalm 50. We begin reading in verse 12. Psalm 50, I'm sorry, beginning in verse 7 through verse 12. I hate that when the minister changes it after you've written it in your notes. You got to scratch it out and put it in something different. I hate that. Psalm 50, verse 7. So not nobody's going to write it in their notes until, okay, is he sure he's saying the right thing here? Okay, he said it three times. It must be right. I'll put it in there. Psalm 50, verse 7. Similar statement to what we read in Exodus 19. Everything belongs to God. It says in verse 7, "Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God." The hymn might be going through your mind. "Hear, O my people, and I'll speak, O Israel, by name." Well, that's where these songs come from. Verse 8, "I will not rebuke you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings, which are continually before me." Why is God going? I mean, is he complaining about that? No, he's not complaining. He's honored by the fact that we honor him. Verse 9, "I will not take a bull from your house nor goats out of your folds." Why? God doesn't need anything from us. Verse 10, "For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills." God owns it all. And yet we grasp for small little portions of what is already God's. Verse 11, "I know all the birds of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you." In other words, he's not hungry. But if he were, he wouldn't come to us, "Oh, please give me a little bit of food." And in this sense, David is kind of poking fun at the pagan gods, whose people bring them food and set it out so the god can eat. And so you've probably seen statues of Buddha and people like that with the outstretched hands. And people come and leave food in the outstretched hands to feed God, because he's got to eat something. If they don't give it to him, he won't be eating. The ancient Greeks had that same pagan concept, that if some calamity took place, it was because they hadn't given stuff to the gods. And so they would up their sacrifices and their offerings to please the gods. God is not like that. He says, "I don't need anything from you. I'm not hungry, and as a result, you better feed me." He closes in verse 11 by saying, "The wild beasts of the field are mine. If I were hungry," verse 12, "I would not tell you. For the world is mine and all its fullness." It helps us to understand and begin with the concept that God owns everything. What we have is not really ours. We've talked previously about this principle of stewardship. What we have is God's, and he expects us to be good stewards of what he gives us. Now, some he gives more to. Some have the ability to produce a great deal, and so they collect more. But it's still God's, and they still have that right responsibility of stewardship. We have left the era in which great men understood that their greatness was to be used for the benefit of the society as a whole. We unfortunately had entered an era of what's typically called American greed. Get as much for yourself as you possibly can. It's the wise business owner that understands part of the reason for his business is to provide for the families of his workers or of her workers. It's part of their responsibility. It's one reason they want the business to succeed, is to care for the families of the workers that are in their employ. And that's a weight for Christian business owners that weighs heavily upon them many, many times. When we understand it all belongs to God, the fact that God then, in point number two, requires a tenth makes sense. Much easier. Point number two, God requires one-tenth from us. A tithe. The word tithe means tenth. It's an old English word for tenth. So God requires a tithe. Now wait a second, everything belongs to God. The earth, he says, and all its fullness is mine. So if it's all God's anyway, should it bother us that he wants a tenth of that? He doesn't charge us for the air we breathe. He doesn't charge us for the water we drink, although the city might. He doesn't charge us for our breathing. He doesn't charge us per pumping beat of our heart. He doesn't charge us for the amazing structure of our body that he's given us. He doesn't charge us for the absolutely almost godlike qualities of the human mind. He doesn't charge us for any of those things. He simply says, I own it all, but what I want from you is a tenth of the increase of your labors. I'll let you keep the other 90% and do with it as you please, as you see fit, if you give me the tenth. Now, we've sometimes said that giving God his tenth is nothing more than taking us out of the category of thieves. That's what it is. We're not paying God's tithe. We're keeping away from being a thief, because God says that tenth is mine. Turn with me, if you would, to Leviticus chapter 27. God requires that one-tenth of the increase of his stuff that comes to us goes back to him. Now, why would God require that? We already read God owns everything. He doesn't need to be fed by us or clothed by us. What is he doing that for? Because he wants us to understand the principle of giving. So with every increase that comes to us, God trains us in giving. Leviticus chapter 27, in verse 1. Maybe we should start in 26. No, I'm just kidding. 27, verse 1. Now the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, and the reason we read verse 1 is these are God's words. He's speaking to Moses. We drop down now to verse 30, which is the subject that we're looking at here. Leviticus 27, verse 30. All the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. God says, you keep 90% of the production that my land, my body, my mind, all that's on loan to you, you keep 90%, but I expect you to learn the principle of giving by giving back to me 10%. Then it says at the end of verse 30, probably the most important part of that phrase or verse is this: it is holy to the Lord. It is holy. What God simply says is that of all the 100% that you produce from the gifts that I have given you, your mind, your body, your ingenuity, your status, your situation, of all the things that I've given you, the top 10% is holy. Holy means sacred. It means set aside for a special purpose. To withhold that 10% that God owns is stealing. We've all been through how many times in our studies and in our learning of God's way what Malachi 3 says, will a man rob God? That's why we say when we give God his tenth, his tithe, well, we shouldn't receive a great applause. We're simply withholding ourselves from being thieves, stealing what is not ours. So in this case, it is holy. The tithe, what we call the first tithe, because this is the first one mentioned, this tithe is holy. That means off limits to us. That's why Malachi tells us to take that tithe is stealing or robbing from God, not to give him that tenth. God's very generous. He allows us to keep 90% for to do with as we please. It's 90% of what we produce with His stuff, His raw materials. Now, if this were only for the temple system, some say, well, tithing was just to support the Levites during the time of the temple. If that were the case, why did Abraham pay a tithe long before there was ever a temple Levitical system at all? Well, tithing is an eternal principle that God invokes upon us so that we learn the way of give. And we show appreciation. When we pay that tithe, we are thanking God for our brain, whatever condition it might be in at this stage of life. We're thanking God for our eyesight, for our hearing, for our sense of taste, our sense of smell. We're thanking God for the place we have to live, for the car we have to drive, no matter what shape that might be in. We're thanking God for the fact that He's given us Sabbath services and an opportunity to be together with His people, His Holy Spirit. It's our way of saying thank you for all God has done. We're giving Him His holy tithe. And God is very pleased when that happens. Abraham paid a tithe because he was thankful to God. Why was it a tithe? Because somewhere in the shadows of history, God taught the principle of tithing. It doesn't show up in the scriptural till the time of Abraham, but it's very clearly the principle from that time forward. It's a universal law for all time as a way of loving and honoring God. And we could turn to many other scriptures that describe that, but that's for a different sermon on tithing. We will turn to one other scripture, and that's in Matthew chapter 23. Matthew 23 is not a pleasant chapter because it talks about hypocrisy. It talks about the Pharisees and their continual play acting, their misinterpretation of God's law, their misuse of God's people. But in the midst of correcting the Pharisees, Christ makes this statement in Matthew 23, verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, for you pay tithe. Well, why would he be condemning them for paying a tithe? Well, he's not condemning them for paying a tithe. He's condemning them for being very specific, and as we would say today, Pharisaic, very nitpicky, about paying exact tithe and missing out on the principle of generosity and kindness and love that makes up God's character. So they tithed each little seed, but they in essence spat on their brother. Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites! You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, mercy, justice, and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So yes, you should be tithing. But these are the things, the character issues that God is really interested in. Mercy and justice and faith. So the Pharisees were leaving those things out, but they were diligently in that little tithing thing. So is tithing the most important law of God? Well, of course not. But it shows a principle of faithfulness toward God and thankfulness and appreciation toward God that's very important. So we understand God owns everything. Out of that 100% that is His, He says, give me a tenth, and you'll be learning my way of give. That's holy. Give me my tenth. That leads us to point number three, then. That's really the focus of what we want to cover today. And that is, God requires that we save a second tithe. God requires that we save a second tithe. Or we could call that a festival tithe, as we see, as we'll cover in the scriptures here. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 14 is probably the most complete scriptural explanation about this second tithe, this festival tithe. It's gotten the name festival tithe because of how God tells us to use this tithe. Now, it's important to understand, right from the start, that Deuteronomy 14, verse 22 starts talking about a different tithe from the holy tithe that we just read about. And we'll point that out as we go along. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly or honestly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. Other scriptures talk about what is produced year by year. In other places we read, well, if it's a seed, it might be the fruit of the tree. It might be the flocks and the herds. In other words, in that day and age, anything that would bring us income and increase was to be tithed upon. And that tithe principle certainly applies to the first tithe. It likewise, same thing applies to the second tithe as well. So the increase that the field brings forth year by year. So when we have increase that the field produces, in other words, our money earns money, our activity earns money or stuff, those things should be tithed upon. So initially in verse 22, this sounds exactly like the first tithe. And this is why some people mumble and jumble all these tithes together as part of this old system and don't pay any attention to it. So verse 22, you shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. But then verse 23 says something very different. This is one of the primary ways we know to differentiate this between first and then now second tithe. Verse 23 says, and you shall eat before the eternal God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, and then the firstborn of your herds and your flocks. So this is a tithe that we eat. This is not a tithe that is holy, that goes to God, is set aside for holy purposes. Now we know that first tithe went to the priests, to the Levites, to support the Levitical system. We know that was certainly the case. This one is a tithe that you eat. So the second tithe is something we save all year long, and then we eat it. In other words, we use it to live. Now it says specifically, eat before the eternal God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. That's a phrase that's used in regard to God's feast days. You keep the feast where God has placed his name. Over and over in the scripture, we're told on the holy day, you keep that holy day where God has placed his name. So you eat that tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil. Most of us today do not subsist on agricultural produce that we produce by our own hands. Well, some of us have gardens and we tithe on that. We give the ministry, the elders, first fruits from our gardens as a principle of tithing. I know every year we try to bring our elders little bitty bags of first fruits from our little garden. This year we had tomatoes coming out our ears, so we've given away lots of those. Nonetheless, this is a tithe that you eat. Most of us don't have new wine or oil or firstborn from herds and flocks. We have a paycheck. And that is tithable income. So it is second tithable as well. Now we'll certainly talk about if we do not have tithable income, then we do not pay a first tithe, nor do we save a second tithe. We might save to keep the feasts, but we don't save a tithe. Because a tithe is a specific delineation that comes from the increase that we have. If we do not have increase, we do not have tithing. So those who are on retirement income, for example, they already have paid in principle tithe on that income in years gone by when they were earning it, and therefore they might not be responsible for a tithe currently. Now, if it was untaxed income, and we receive it after retirement, more than likely if we haven't tithed on it before, a tithe is due upon it now. So some of those things we can certainly talk over individually so that everyone can be sure they're being obedient to God as he would require. End of verse 23 says the purpose of keeping the feast and eating this tithe, that you may learn to fear the eternal your God always. There is something very special about going to the place where God has set his name and eating this tithe. It helps us to learn to fear or be in awe of the eternal our God. It makes his plan come to life in ways that cannot be duplicated at home. just cannot be duplicated. This is why God says, get up out of your homes, go to the place where I've set my name, and keep my feasts. Save in order to do so. Verse 24 says how we practically apply this command to save a tithe and eat it. Verse 24, if the journey is too long for you, so you're not able to carry the tithe. Isn't it interesting? He doesn't say, if the journey is too long for you, so you're not able to get there or go. Now, certainly there are legitimate reasons that health-wise one may not be able to attend the feast. But what he says, if the journey is too long for you, so you're not able to carry that tithe. I mean, they literally would harvest their field and carry bushels of wheat or oats or whatever it might have been at that time of year. Literally would carry these bushels of produce to the feast. And if it's just too far, too difficult to carry all those things, or if the place where your Lord your God chooses to put His name is too far from you when the Eternal your God has blessed you, then what? Don't go? Forget it? Pretend it doesn't exist? No. Then, verse 25, you shall exchange it for money. You take that tithe, that bushel of grain, or that firstborn calf, and you sell it. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Eternal your God chooses. So his command is very clear. You take that tithe. In this case, most of us in our circumstances skip the first couple steps because we're not producing wheat. We're not producing firstborn of the flock and the herd. We're producing cash money. We get it in a paycheck. It comes into our bank, however we might do it. So we were already there at verse 25. You shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand. Today we have the option of taking all that money in a little plastic card that's about 3 inches by 2 inches. Principle is the same. You take that money, you go to the feast. Take the money in your hand, go to the place which the Eternal your God chooses. Verse 26, and you shall spend that money. The basic principle of second tithe, that it is to be spent at the feast location where God has set his name. You take that money in your hand, go to the place where God has chosen, and you spend that money. So in general terms, second tithe or festival tithe is spent at the feast locations. Now, of course, you have to get back and forth from the festival location. So spending some of that tithe to get back and forth to the feast location is certainly acceptable. When it says if the way is too far from you, you're not able to carry these bushels of wheat, the indication might be, in some cases, it might have been several days' travel. Or maybe long, long days of travel to get to the place where God has set his name. So using that money for travel expenses to get to the feast, to be able to worship God, is certainly an acceptable use. To reshingle the house with excess second tithe is not an appropriate use of that festival tithe. You take it in your hand as the command. We go to the place where God has set his name and we spend it there. What do we spend it on? Verse 26 tells us. Not reshingling the house back home. That'll take care of itself. We'll get to that at the right time, the right place. Let's strive to be obedient to God. You shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. Wow. What kinds of things? We might say, well, my heart desires a new Camaro. I'm going to go buy the feast, you know, go to the feast and buy a Camaro. That's not an appropriate use. That's not eating and drinking the tithe. That's not used for living expenses. Whatever your heart desires. And then it gives examples. For oxen or sheep. I mean, you go to the feast. Was he talking about here? You go to the feast and expand your herd of oxen and sheep. You go to the auction at the feast. Call it the Mount Hope, the Mount Pocono auction. I'm going to go buy a herd of Herefords or Brown Swiss or whatever breed you might like. go buy me a couple Angus to take home and breed. No, it's talking about you like a nice steak. If you can afford that, that's the time to spend that money. When we faithfully save a tithe of our income, we have in 1 week the opportunity to spend more money during that week than any other week during the year. We have 1/10 of our income to spend on 1/52nd of the year. So God, in essence, says, compared to our normal standard of living, we are rich. That's certainly true, regardless of what level our income might be. So, for oxen, in other words, things that we might not normally buy. In our day and age, of course, oxen is not an unusual dish. Because of freezing and refrigeration, most of us can enjoy oxen virtually any time of year. We go to the Giant Eagle, we give them $5, and they give us a pound of what used to be oxen. And we put it up in patties and we fry it on our grill. That's not the way it was in the old days. During Bible times, you killed the ox, you ate it. Because there was no way to refrigerate it. You might be able to dry some of it, but you had to eat it. You could salt some of it, but you basically had to eat it. So you get to the feast, you slaughter this ox, and you have a feast. You literally have a feast. So in this case, they might kill a sheep and have leg of lamb, or mutton, or lamb chops, or the various parts of the lamb. Lamb hoof for dessert. Okay, I'm kidding, you don't eat hoof. You can kill this lamb and have a feast. So that's what he's talking about. The primary use of our second tithe is for housing and food and drink while we are at the feast. Now, going to play to the place where God has set his name. Certainly to see the area is an appropriate use of second tithe. To enjoy feast activities with the brethren, an appropriate use of second tithe. Again, to reshingle the house back home. Buy a new car, not appropriate use of second tithe. Because this is the guideline God gives us. Spend that money for whatever your heart desires. For oxen, for sheep, for wine, for similar drink. Whatever your heart desires, you shall eat. Primary emphasis, food, drink, and housing while we're at the feast. It is to be a feast. So you might say, well, I could use a new wardrobe. Spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on a new wardrobe, not appropriate. Or to buy a new dress or two. To keep God's feast or a new suit, certainly appropriate. To appear before God in our very best, honoring Him as a result, certainly appropriate. Each individual works through those situations themselves. To buy small gifts for our children, of course, appropriate. For our husband, for our wife, yes. To buy ourselves new stuff, it's not the purpose of second tithe. It's not the time just to increase our materialism. You shall eat there, verse 26, before the eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. It's a great gift. Verse 27, in all that rejoicing, he says, you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. What was the principle there? They were not to forget the Levite. How much second tithe did the Levite have in this case? Under the old Levitical system, they were not allowed to be landowners. So they would have nothing. The year, what the field brought forth year by year would be nothing because they didn't own land. So part of the Israelites' generosity was being sure to take care of those who were unable to take care of themselves. In other places he talks about making sure you care for the Levite and the fatherless and the widow. Those who had no means of income and producing increase or very little means of doing so. So when we save in advance and we carefully budget, we can enjoy a literal and spiritual feast without guilt, without worry that comes from doing it backwards. Keeping the feast and then somehow hoping we can pay for it later. When the cart is behind the horse, it goes very smoothly. When the cart is in front of the horse gets a bruised nose on the first step. So God simply says, here's the law, here's the principle. You shall surely save keep a tithe of that increase that the field brings forth year by year. Set it aside so that when you know where God has placed His name, you can go there and eat and drink and enjoy the fellowship. We all know some of the best fellowship we've ever enjoyed is around the meal table. So if you're blessed with a great deal of increase, it's incumbent that we help others who aren't. So the church long ago has enacted the principle of the tithe of the tithe, where we take 10% of our second tithe and we send it to the church so that we all can feast together. And assistance can be given to those who have no increase, have no job, have sickness or illness that doesn't allow them to produce increase. So they likewise can keep the feast, go to where God has set His name, and receive that outstanding spiritual blessing and vision that the feast gives us. So the use of second tithe certainly is appropriate on any one of God's holy days, where He sets His name a place, we go and worship Him. Most of that second tithe will be used during the Feast of Tabernacles, when God says, get up out of your homes, go to the place where I've set my name for those 7 days, tack on that eighth day, keep the feast as God has commanded. When we do that, there's a tremendous blessing to it. Tremendous physical blessing, much more so a tremendous spiritual blessing. Now, why would God have us spend one-tenth of the income He's given us during 1/52nd of the year? Well, because He wants us to be picturing something. He wants us to be picturing the conditions that will be extant in the world tomorrow when Christ returns and God's government is set up on the earth. He wants us to see what that is like. He wants us to understand that when everybody is in the same spot, striving to be obedient to God, living by God's law, striving to be kind and helpful and follow God's principles, what an outstanding environment it can be. God designed that feast to build vision within us. And then when we have to go back home to what is currently the real evil world, that vision burns all the brighter. How many times do we say, man, I wish I didn't have to go home after the feast? That's an appropriate reaction. We want God's kingdom to come. We've got a small picture, a vision of what it's supposed to be like, what it can be like. And we yearn for that all the more. So the Feast of Tabernacles is likewise designed to give us vision. So when we faithfully save in advance and budget, we can enjoy the feast without any guilt or worry. It's all taken care of. We've carefully budgeted this out and that out. Most of you probably have your family feast budget, and you set aside, here's how much it's going to cost us for the travel, here's how much it's going to cost us for the room that we'll be staying in, here's how much we have to spend for food, so we can have a really nice dinner out one night, and it's McChicken the other nights of the week, you know, whatever it is we work out, we've got our little cook stove, and we cook in our room, or we heat up our ramen noodles, or whatever it might be. We've done all those things over the years, you probably have as well. There's been good years, there's been lean years, we've all seen them, and yet there's tremendous blessings that come from all of those. Let's go on to one more point, one final point that we'll talk about, and that is God directs the place and the time of use. God directs the place and the time of our use of festival tithe. Turn back a page to Deuteronomy chapter 12. We'll begin reading in verse 10. Deuteronomy 12 and verse 10. God is expressing to Israel through Moses that when they get into the promised land, here's the instructions He wants them to follow. Verse 10. But when you cross over Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and He gives you rest from all your enemies round about so that you dwell safely, verse 11, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make His name abide. Now we understand that became Jerusalem. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings of your hand, all your choice offerings which you vow to the Lord. Verse 12, and you shall rejoice before the eternal God, you and your sons and daughters, your male, female servants, and the Levite that's within your gates, since he has no portion or inheritance with you. So we begin to see that God is instructing them. Take the offerings to this location, give them there, and rejoice. Verse 13, take heed to yourself that you do not offer burnt offerings in every place that you see. God wanted a centralization to his work. Centralization does two things. It allows us to do things we would not otherwise be able to do, and it protects the system, it protects doctrine, it protects integrity. We've certainly seen that on our level. When people go off on their own, away from the centralized work, they come up with all kinds of unusual ideas and doctrines. Centralization in this case was a good thing. Now, it does have its cautions, there's no doubt about that. The centralized system can be very impersonal. We have to be careful of some of those things, no doubt. But there is good that can be accomplished. Verse 14. But in the place which the Lord your God chooses, in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within all your gates, whatever your heart desires, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. The clean and the unclean may eat of it, of the gazelle and deer alike. Now pause for a moment. Not very many weeks ago, I received a question about verse 15 over the internet from an individual. I think he lives in Maine or New Hampshire. But nonetheless, he said, it looks like we've gotten this thing of unclean and clean all wrong. Because here in Deuteronomy 15, it says, according to the blessing the Lord your God has given you, the clean and the unclean you may eat of it. Aha! So, does that mean that when we rejoice before God, we can now break out the pork roast after all? We can have that pork chop and that lobster tail? Is that what he's talking about? No. It's quite easy to explain when we understand the situation. God is saying, when you move into the promised land, do a centralized system. Go to where I set my name and do everything there. That'll keep it safe. But is that the only place you can eat meat? Of course not. You can eat meat in all the cities you want. Just go ahead and slaughter that and eat it. Now, when you were at Jerusalem, at the tabernacle, at the temple, what would happen if you had touched a dead animal or a dead body? You were now unclean and had to go outside the gate overnight and then be sprinkled with the water of separation. You could be brought back into the group. So they were unclean from until sunset the next day. So when it talks about here, according to the blessing of the eternal your God, which he has given you, the clean and unclean may eat of it. That's talking about people. It's not talking about an unclean animal. If you happen to be back home and you touched a dead body, did you have to stay outside the gate till night? No, that was only in the area where God had chosen. They were unclean, but they could still eat meat. That's all that means. It's talking about the person. It's not talking about the meal. The clean and the unclean may eat of it. Because then it goes on to say, of the gazelle and the deer alike. He didn't say pig and lobster alike. He's talking about only clean animals. So he's emphasizing that. Verse 16, only you shall not eat the blood. You shall pour it on the earth like water. You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or your new wine or your oil. Which tithe must this be talking about? It has to be talking about the second tithe, because it's a tithe you eat. It's not a tithe that's holy before God and goes to the Levites, because they had no part or inheritance. They didn't have land to produce their own crops from. You may not eat it within your gates, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, or your oil, or the firstborn of your herd or your flock, or any of your offerings which you vow, or your freewill offerings, or your heave offerings of the land of your hand. But you must eat them before the eternal God in the place which the eternal your God chooses, you and your son, your daughter, your manservant, male, female servant, and the Levites within your gates. You shall rejoice before the eternal your God in all which he put into your hands. So God tells us where and how to use that tithe. So again, to purchase, we were hearing one person say a number of years ago, we bought our house a feast gift. I said, you did what? Yeah, we bought our house a feast gift. Well, tell me more. Well, the house carpet was getting pretty ratty. So we got plenty of second tithe. We just used a couple thousand of our second tithe to re-carpet the house. I said, you did what? No, you didn't take that tithe, turn it into money, take it to the place where God has set his name. That's not an appropriate use of second tithe. Just not an appropriate use. So again, gifts certainly to help enhance the meaning of the feast, the joy of the feast, the enjoyment of the feast, certainly. But we must be careful that the Feast of Tabernacles does not become the Church of God's Christmas. And every year, what do the kids look forward to? Getting stuff at the feast! Bad idea. Oh, should we have them enjoy the feast? Absolutely. One of the most enjoyable things we did as a family in keeping the feast as our children grew up was go to the grocery store on opening the day before opening service, you know, before opening night services. Giving the kids a list, you can buy five. We started, I think, with 10. It was a disaster because it took like 8 hours in the grocery store. You can buy 10 things, whatever you want to eat, you can buy. And we must have spent hours in the grocery store. So we cut it down next year to five. Five things. They go through the store and they're calculating, brothers and sisters working together. Which one? Well, if you get the Captain Crunch, I'll get the Twinkies. And, you know, back and forth and back and forth they went. But it was enjoyable. It was keeping the feast. It was eating and drinking something special, something enjoyable. So make sure for our children there's something special along the way to eat and to drink. God often emphasizes special celebrations with special foods. So let's use that tithe properly. Brethren, God has given us outstanding annual feasts to teach us His great plan. We haven't focused a great deal on the meaning of the feast because that wasn't the purpose of the sermon. But in this case, preparing to keep the feast in a responsible way so that we can focus on the meaning. And part of the meaning of the feast is eating and drinking and picturing the conditions that people will enjoy once the kingdom of God is set up on the earth and is ruling the earth. The kind of peace and joy and prosperity that the world will enjoy is shown in small cardboard copy by our keeping of the feast. Now again, those who've been blessed with a great deal of second tithe should not be simply trying to figure out how can I possibly spend all of this money on myself during this time. That's the time to especially look out for the widow among us, for the needy, for the fatherless, for those who cannot provide for themselves. So the church certainly has that fund again set up of festival assistance. So every widow, if her health allows, can go to the feast because funds can be provided for her through the generosity of others who have more than they can spend in that 7 or 10 day period, depending on how their feast trip works. So, brethren, God gives us His annual feast to teach us the great plan of Him rescuing humanity and building His family. Let's all strive to be faithful to God in the saving of our festival tithe so that we might be obedient to Him and observe His feasts as He commands.